colleagues for being here. Representative Greenlich's not my vice chair today. Where's Representative Thatcher?
She's away today.
She's away?
Delpo and Thatcher both away today.
Okay. Why don't do we have signups for the HJRs, EHRs?
Isn't that nice?
Jesse, did you get, have you relayed our conversation from earlier, that secret conversation that we had?
I had a presentation
about it. Not so secret of a conversation now, was it?
45 minutes is what I heard.
Ready?
Oh, boy.
Okay.
We at this time, I guess we will...
This is here for HJR.
Okay, great. At this time, I guess we will move forward with our informational hearing from the Secretary of State's office, if that indulges the committee. Well, I tell you what, we've got people to testify on HJR 1. Let's we'll do that real quick. Yeah, thanks, man. Sorry about that.
Trial run.
We'll open a public hearing on HJR 1. Cletus, you want to give us a summary of HJR 1?
Mr. Chair and committee members, HJR 1 amends Oregon Constitution requiring annual sessions, odd years not to exceed 120 calendar days, and even years not to exceed 60 calendar days.
Thank you.
Mrs.
Kathy Eden, would you like to come forward and testify on HJR 1?
Well, I thought Representative Lincoln had to be here, and
He said he was not going to be here.
He was not going to be here?
The same also comes in this regard.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As you know, the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization, and we're very much in favor of annual sessions. We believe that the legislature should be permitted to have annual sessions, and we held that position for over 20 years. However, the exact structure of such sessions, we believe, needs very careful discussion. We share with many others the belief that Oregon's growth in population and state budget responsibilities calling for fiscal decisions to be made on the short projections for a 24-month period leaves a lot to be desired when it comes to making good fiscal choices. There is a need for flexibility, which annual sessions could provide both in program policy and financial review and decisions. However, we are aware of the budgetary implications for annual sessions and also recognize that we have a citizen legislature, which means that people would be required to be away from their businesses twice as long, not twice as long, but at least every year. We think that some combination of briefer sessions for the odd number of years and an even briefer one for the even number of years, some kind of configuration like that, probably could be reasonable. We do not support HJR1's contention that you would only have budget considerations for that long period in the odd number of years. We believe you should have both public policy and budget decisions made in that longer period, and then restrict the second session, the second year, to budget. We think this could be a very efficient and effective use of both time and resources. We encourage the committee to have some serious discussion about annual sessions, and we believe that it would be helpful if you brought in political scientists, political leaders, budget analysts, and the public to join in that discussion. But we hope that you will discuss annual sessions. Given our budgetary problems in the last decade, both with surpluses and without them, having an ability to review the biennial budget in the middle and midstream to see if you need to change course, we believe would be very productive. Thank you.
You're welcome. Kathy, has the league taken a position on on raising the salaries of legislators?
No, we don't have a position in that. Other than we believe they should be adequately funded, whatever that means.
It's very broad. I know that some of the concerns that I've heard with the annual sessions is just that, is trying to find time off every year, not so much for the small business owner, but for someone that's employed by an employer.
Well, it has to do with your career. However, whether you're employed by someone else or whether you're self-employed, it does certainly have ramifications for people.
Is the league okay with the, I realize, not just the discussion of budgetary issues during the 120, but is the league okay with the number of days that the bill is set forward, or they'd like to see that amended? Or
right, it's a maximum of 120 days. If we didn't have to go that long, you wouldn't have to. But 6 months, if the legislature is disciplined, and if you know that you're going to come back for a shorter period of time to review the budget, we believe that would be an adequate amount of time, yes.
Great, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Are there any other people wishing to testify on this? Andy, okay. We will close the public hearing on HJR 1. We will open the public hearing on HR 1. Is there anybody here to testify on HR 1?
No, sir.
Colleagues, is there any discussion on H.R. 1?
Can you read one?
Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair and Committee, H.R. 1, the 73rd Legislative Assembly thanks the 72nd Legislative Assembly for serving in the House of Representatives.
Any discussion on H.R. 1? Representative Farr, then Representative March.
Is this something that's done every session?
I don't know about every session. I don't recall it being done last session. Was in the March, do you?
I don't think it was done last session, and I can't remember the 01 session whether it was done, but it's kind of a nice idea.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if it was tradition in the legislature.
I'm sorry.
It's a new tradition.
I can add one other point to it.
Representative Mark, you had a question?
Yeah, actually, it was just a comment, and that was that, I think even though I don't recall it being done last session, it is something that it's kind of nice to honor the folks who worked hard and served the legislature well. The only thought, although this is only a House resolution, I mean, we might consider thanking the senators who are no longer with us as well. Even though they didn't serve on our side necessarily, a lot of them maybe were former representatives.
Right. I think that, you know, the bill specifies non-attorney members of the House.
Right.
I think it could be the prerogative of the Senate if they so chose. I think there's some amendments that would take out Representative Bates, Representative Hobson, Representative Kefouri, and Representative Monis Anderson, and spruce up the bill a little bit. So basically thanking the Republican members.
You made me remark that.
Well,
now that's a strange thing.
No, but it's nice of you to keep in Prozanski, Verger.
That's amendment number 2-6. Colleagues, we're going to stand at ease for just 1 second and allow Representative Greenleck to come. We'll come back into session as we were standing at ease.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Resolution 1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March moves House Resolution 1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Annetta, would you please call the roll?
President Gaffel.
Excused.
President
Barr. Aye.
President Greenwood.
Aye.
President Holby.
Aye.
President March.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. HR 1 passes, and we'll probably assign Representative Jensen. Is it Representative Hansen's bill?
It's both of them.
Both of them.
Okay.
We can join.
Well, we'll jointly carry it. Just put Jensen for now, for the sake of having a lead, senior member. Thank you, colleagues. At this time, I think, what's that?
Oh, sorry.
It's closed, correct? Thank you. All right. At this time, I think we'll bring you back forward. Thank you for your patience in letting Mr. Greenlich vote.
So, Chair Kitts and members of the committee, I'm Julie Pearson. I'm the project executive for the Centralized Voter Registration Project, which is a part of HAVA, which I'm sure you've all heard of, the Help America Vote Act. And you asked us to come and demo where we are in our application. So with me today is Steve Toft with Sabre Consulting and John Lindbeck, you all know, from the Director of Elections. So since we only have a half hour now, about, is that right? We'll go ahead and start with our presentation. There's a lot of modules within this, and it was actually designed as a tool to help the county clerks manage elections. And so you're seeing it from their end of what they'll be using. But we thought you'd be most interested in the voter registration piece and the duplicate check and how voters move from one county to the next. So we'll go through that first. If you have other questions after that or want to see other pieces of the application, we'll do that afterwards. So, Steve, I'll let you take it away.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. Appreciate the opportunity to show you our stuff because I think we have a great product here and want to show you at least one major aspect, which is the voter registration module. So I'm going to be showing you three things. I'm going to be showing you how we add a new voter in the system fairly quickly. And as part of that process, I'll show you the voter registration card image that gets scanned in and stored with each voter's record so that it can be viewed online and signature. I'm going to show you what happens if we try to enter a new voter that appears to have a lot of the same information as an already existing voter. This is our duplicate check that I'm talking about, and we'll show you how we handle that scenario. And then finally, we will move a voter from one county to another and show you how that gets handled, and then I guess we'll take whatever questions you may have and go from there. This is the main menu that our counties will see when they come into the Oregon Centralized Voter Registration application. So what I'm going to be showing you right now is this voter registration module. We can perhaps talk about others if there's time later, but this is the heart and soul, meat and potatoes, so to speak, of this entire application. It's basically a database of all of the registered voters in the state of Oregon. Each voter in the state has a statewide unique voter ID number that will follow them from county to county. Regardless of where they live in the county, they retain that same unique voter ID number. So the system can track them, tell when they voted, if they have already voted, or multiple ballots have been issued to them, if they've moved from one county to the other, and so forth. The system can track all that. Okay. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and open the voter registration module, and we'll try entering a new voter.
This is test data, so you won't see real people in here. So.
Yeah, no real people in here.
I was hoping to find the chair's name.
Come on. I voted for myself. It's no big secret.
That's not going to tell you that.
All right, our first task here is to enter a brand new voter, and this will be one that doesn't exist in the system and doesn't have... There is no other voter in the system that's close enough for a duplicate check to pop up, so we'll see that in just a moment. So this top line of fields across the top of the screen there, these are the critical pieces of information to help uniquely identify each voter, and that's what will be used as part of the duplicate checking process when we try to add a new person into the system. So I'm going to just add a new voter. Oh, sorry. He has a numeric middle name. I don't know if you've seen that before. But it's a Star Trek character. We got going here.
Number 7.
Just cracking myself up. I was thinking of various middle names with numeric numbers and what I could come up with, so please go on.
Sure. There are actually two checks that take place every time a new voter is entered into the system. One of those is the one you're seeing now, which is the DMV check. We're basically trying to find out up front if the voter we're trying to enter already exists as a person in the DMV record database. In this case, there is a record out there of a user that has a different date of birth, so that may or may not be the same person. If we determine it is, then we can accept that voter. If not, then we say no and move on and continue adding information.
So he's entering now like he's entering off the registration card that they get in the office.
Okay, this is an address library check. We didn't see this earlier today, but if we enter an address, the system always wants to check it against the county's existing address library, which is just a collection of all the valid street segments and addresses within that county. So this one, for some reason, didn't pass muster here, so I need to figure out what's going on. But the county will be able to research that and figure out whether maybe there's something incorrect on the voter registration card they couldn't quite read, so they entered it incorrectly or whatever. So there are ways to research that.
Like a new subdivision just created?
Right.
The street file has all the precincts and splits and districts based on what they put in their database.
At any point, we've heard a bill recently, and there's been some concern on this proof of citizenship issue that's going on. Is there any, at any point with the conversion of the existing system as we have it and going fully to the centralized voter system, realizing that it delineates, you know, duplicated registrations county to county and all that, is there any point or anywhere on this where Perry Winkle has to prove they're a citizen before they are put into this process, or is it just simply the DMV records as currently it is?
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. The system reflects what is current state law and federal law, and so the answer to that is no.
So that, again, it's the affidavit?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we've entered the new information. Now we need to save this new record. And when we do that, assuming there are no problems with what we've entered, the system will tell us that the voter record was successfully saved and will give us the automatically generated unique voter ID number that will stay with this voter forever. This number will never be reused for any other voter, and this voter will keep it regardless of where they move throughout the state. Okay, so that was a fairly simple process of adding a new voter. I want to show you an example of an existing voter that has a scanned image of their voter registration card, because this is a new voter. Typically, it's a two-part process. We enter the data and we scan in the card, and then the card image will show up in the right half of the screen, that big blank area. Because this is a new voter and we don't have a scanner with us, we can't do that process. But I do want to show you another voter that does already have that information. So now we have the scanned registration card, which takes up most of that image viewing area, but at the bottom of that we have actually a separate little viewing box that shows an enlarged version of the same signature. It's just showing it zoomed in so that it's easier to read and to check and so forth. Any given voter could potentially have multiple documents, including multiple registration cards that have been scanned in for them. The latest, greatest one is the one that's supposed to show up here first, and I think I have another voter out there that actually has multiple voters. And actually, let me show you what that looks like. real quick.
That's multiple cards on file, not multiple.
Right. Thank you. Okay, here's an example where we have multiple cards that are on file. And this could be the case because over time the person has moved, submitted new cards, and new cards have been scanned in on top of or in addition to any cards that exist already. And when we are doing a search for an existing voter, one of the things that shows up here is if we're not sure of the results that we're getting here when we're searching for a voter and want to verify who they are, we can look at a lot of information about their existing record from this little pop-up window. And in this particular case, you'll notice that this person has multiple signatures on file. So if necessary, we can look at all those different signatures that accumulate over time and verify if the signatures change over time or whatever. So we have multiple signatures possible to view here.
John, if my signature doesn't match one of those three, or you deem it not to match, what's the process at that point?
If we're talking about a ballot?
Yeah.
The county is required to send you a notice or to notify you. If there's enough time before the election, they send it in the mail. If not, they try to phone you and let you know that there's a problem matching your signature, and they'd ask you to come in and help figure out why.
Verify whether, okay.
You mentioned, if you don't mind just jumping in, you have an auto-generated unique ID. What if a voter, say, for example, moves out of state, you've somehow found out that, you know, like the mail came back and the county clerk says, okay, no longer valid voter. Do you purge them from the system? Do you leave them in the system? I was thinking of somebody maybe in the military who moved to North Carolina or something, then comes back and then wants to register again. Do they get the same original unique number? And so this will be a huge growing database over time.
You retain your original. Once you're assigned a voter ID in Oregon, you'll retain that. So if you come back, you'll have the same.
Until death. Until death do you part. Okay, thank you.
Now what I'd like to show you is an example of trying to enter a new voter who has enough characteristics that are similar to an already existing voter in the system so that that triggers the system's duplicate alert, a duplicate checking process. I've entered the last name, first name, middle initial, and birth date. And because there is already a voter record that exists in this database that's substantially similar to this one, the system pops up this duplicate voters window. And in this case, there's only one other voter record that seems close enough to be included on this list. But it's possible there could be more than one if they're close enough. And you'll notice on the left-hand side of this record that's displaying, there's a percentage sign on the header and a number. This is the percent confidence level or confidence rating that this voter we're trying to enter matches the voter on this pop-up list that we're seeing. And of course, the higher the confidence number, the more likely it is that it is in fact the same voter. So at this point, the county clerk, county elections person would have to do a little bit more research to verify, is this really in fact the same person? And we have a number of buttons on the bottom of this pop-up window that lets the county person do further research to verify, are these really the same people or are they not the same person, and then act accordingly. If it is, then they just bring up that record. If it's not, then they say it's not a match, and then they continue adding this new voter to the system.
Can I ask one follow-up question, Representative March's question? What if somebody simply moves out of state? Let's say Dale Smith packs up from Seacrest Place and moves to Florida. How would you know that, number one? Or is it simply hoping that whoever moves into his place is going to register to vote and that address is going to pop it up?
Mr. Chairman, John Lindback again. You know that through a variety of possibilities. One could be that in the next election, a ballot is sent to that person, and since ballots are not forwardable, the post office would return it to the county clerk's office, and the county clerk would then know, since those ballots are not forwardable, that that person has moved, not knowing where, and that is enough to place that voter on the inactive list, and they will be mailed no more ballots until some information comes back on that voter. If the voter goes to another state and registers in another state, it's possible that the county in that other state could notify the county in this instance that this voter has moved and registered there, which is enough information for the county to take them off the voter rolls. Or the voter could notify the county that they've moved. There's a variety of different things that can happen. I would say the most common thing, though, is the non-deliverable ballot. It's the most common.
Let me just run a scenario by you very, very quickly. I'm 18. I graduated high school. I registered to vote. I was a July birthday. Graduated in June. Registered to vote in July. Voted that November. At my parents' house, for example.
Correct.
But I didn't change my address, but moved out of state to go to school. So, in theory, my ballot's still going to go to my parents' house because it's not a forwardable, or because there's no need to forward, but I don't live there. So something like that could happen, and then what? So that's part A. Part B is, what if I, in the new state, I registered to vote there, but... You follow what I'm saying? If I'm moving out of my parents' house, I'm probably getting bank statements and probably getting all kinds of mail that had been sent there. Is there a way that this system would catch that? I mean, is it hopeful that the entire United States goes to the centralized voter system, and therefore if I register in Washington County, Oregon, that Pierce County, Washington, is going to cross that?
Mr. Chairman, some of the original versions of HAVA required all of the state systems that were to be set up to communicate with each other. That was removed from the final versions of the bill, I presume, because it was so technically mind-boggling for people to try and figure out how to do that, that they decided it was impractical. All is not lost, however, in that there is at least discussion among states about setting up regional compacts in which we could run our voter lists, compare our voter lists with each other, at least on a regional basis, to try and solve some of that problem. Without that, we are, every state is vulnerable to those voters that move out of state, and it's possible that they could register in more than one place and vote in more than one place.
Thank you.
What I'd now like to show you is the process of moving a voter from one county to another. So in this database, we are going to be moving a voter from Lane County to Lincoln County, and we'll just show you how that process works. Typically, what will happen in most cases is that a voter will move to the destination county, and then they will either mail in and drop off their new voter registration card because they've re-registered for the new county, and the county will go ahead and process it as though it's a new voter registration because they don't know any different. But when they do that, since that voter really is already in the system in a different county, the system knows that because it has all this identifying information about them, like their name, their date of birth, and voter ID number, and so forth. So they will pop up again on this duplicate list, and then the county elections person can handle it from there. So that's what I want to show you, is we're going to simulate that process. So I basically have, I'm simulating the fact that I have received a voter registration card from this voter I'm typing in, Sean Campbell in this case, and as soon as I get Sean in there, we'll see what happens. All right, so my assumption is that Sean Campbell was a new voter, but when I type his identifying information in, I see this duplicate voter screen pop up, and it looks like the same person, but notice, we moved him earlier in the session, so he's now in Lincoln County, but he was in Lane County, so this is probably not going to work quite as well as I'd hope, but I can at least go through the process. But this does pop up, this duplicate, because this person appears to be the same voter. And in this case, it is. He's coming from a different county. So we will select this voter. And what's normally happens in a case where you have someone actually coming from another county is the county showing here will show up in red to flag the fact that this person's address, as it exists in the system now, is in a county other than the one that the elections person is signed on as. So I'm signed on as a Lincoln County elections worker. This would say Lane County in big red letters, and I would know that they are already registered in another county. So to complete the process, I would clear the address. And when I do that, it changes the county from the old county to my county, and then I go ahead and log in the information, the new address and other information as necessary, and save the record. So the system keeps track of that voter and knows that they were once in another county, now they're in this county, and it lets us know that with this duplicate pop-up that takes place, and then we can deal with it from there. So this unique voter ID number follows these voters no matter where they are in Oregon, and the system knows where they are. Even though I'm logged in as a particular county's elections worker, I'm actually able to, the system is able to access the entire statewide database to do this duplicate checking process.
I have a question for you. So when you find a duplicate voter, does your system automatically delete the old county that the voter came from if it's a duplicate, or and then go with the new county as its permanent address?
Representative Foley and members of the committee, what they the standards committee has decided is you can pull a registered voter into your county, but you can't push them out. So as soon as you get a registration in your county and they're already registered in another county, you change that. They're not deleted from the database, but it's now showing that they're in your county. And the history of where you've been before will be in the system.
But yes,
they're not deleted.
They're not deleted, but their county has changed.
Right, their county
at that
changed.
Point. So they're not registered in both counties at that point.
Right.
Julie, I think I'd like John Lindbeck. You can like to
please. So that if they show up at the other county to vote, they won't be allowed to vote at the other
right.
county. Is that right?
Okay, right.
But we think you live in Lincoln County rather than.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that it's sort of a Representative Hovey, it sort of depends on what's going on there. If it's a case where you're just trying to transfer that record of that same voter, then you would transfer the record from one county to another. If it's a case where somebody's sort of fraudulently trying to register to vote in more than one county, we don't want to delete either one of those records because we want time to figure out what's going on and for the counties to confer with each other and report to us and so on and sort of deal with that person from a legal standpoint. So it sort of depends on the circumstances what happens to that record.
Mr. Chair?
Would you
prosecute someone who was voting fraudulently?
Yes, we do.
And can you say what the sentence or what the penalty would be?
You know, what I'd like to do, Representative Farr, if that's okay, is go back and look at some of our most recent prosecutions and report to you exactly what they are. They are felony convictions mm-hmm. in most cases, and but in order to speak with precision, I'd rather give you something in writing on that.
Big committee, let's try to. I mean, and I think that's a very good question. Let's try to keep our questions geared toward the actual centralized voter presentation that we have here, so that we don't draw it out. That's a great question. But if we could keep them geared toward this, it'd probably make it run smoother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to follow what you just said because I'm not sure I understand. This person we just saw sends in a current registration that says he lives in Lincoln County.
Mm-hmm.
How? And you said, well, it would depend whether it's fraudulent or not fraudulent. I mean, what would give you any indication? I mean, the assumption would be, to me, that's his newest address, and that's why he's doing it.
Signature card check.
Well, but if it's the same person, I mean, it's the same person.
Right, but if it is.
I don't understand why you'd do anything except go with his latest record.
Yeah, go ahead and answer the question.
Greenlee, on the voter registration card, you're asked to write your old address and your old county. If, for example, if you live in Marion County and move to Polk County tomorrow, and you register to vote in Polk County, but you don't indicate that you have a registration in another county. The counties need to ask the question, that's all, to try and determine if there's something fraudulent going on or if this is just an innocent mistake by that person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Chair Kitts, I also wanted to mention, too, that whenever somebody moves from one county to another county, in the system, when they're moved, there's a message that gets auto-generated to the originating county telling them that this voter has moved. So they'll get automatically a message in the system that they can access that tells them this person has moved to a new county. So
great.
They're aware of it.
Thank you for the clarification.
Sure.
Why don't you go back to the main screen? That was basically the voter registration piece, and you can see how duplicates show and also how voters move from one county to the other. If there's no questions about that, we could just briefly go over the other parts of the application if you'd like.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question about the duplicate?
Please.
I think you'll find most of us are probably as familiar with what those voting records look like as you guys are. We spend a lot of time with them. I frequently find a sort of R. David Johnson and Robert D. Johnson with the same birthday and the same record. Will your new system find ways to deal with, say, two same birthdays at the same household and things like that? Is there going to be more of those kind of cross-record matchings with multiple fields rather than with exactly
settings.
The same?
If I could, Chair Kitts and Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, let me talk about that a little bit. We actually have a system configuration module that helps us, among other things, address that particular issue. What we have is, perhaps I can show it to you just briefly, and maybe you'll see what I'm talking about here. This is what we call a duplicate configuration screen, where we actually set up different levels of confidence on whether a person is actually a duplicate of an existing voter or not based on varying combinations of the specific key fields for each voter. So, for example, if the, as it shows in this configuration example, if the Social Security number, date of birth, and other information are the same between two voters, then the confidence level is 100%, meaning we deem this to be, in fact, the same person. But there are different levels of matching, different fields that might or might not match, maybe fewer match. So if you have a case where two people with the same date of birth match, maybe one or two other pieces of information match, that might be a lower level of confidence that it's the same person. So the state can configure however many confidence levels they'd like to with varying combinations so that when something occurs where a certain combination of fields between two voters match, then the system will pop up a duplicate and give you this confidence level that this is a 75% probability it's the same person, 95%, 50%, and then based on that level of confidence, the policies kick in as to what sort of checking and so forth to do to verify and so on.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions about the voter registration module? So you want to just briefly describe the other modules here?
Sure.
Ballot processing?
Show them the signature.
Okay, we'll show you the signature check on ballot processing. That might be of interest.
Okay, what I'm showing you now is we're going into the ballot processing module where we receive ballots and process them in batches, and each batch is associated with a particular election. And so what we have here is a mock election set up for demonstration purposes that has one batch of ballots that have come in so far, and we have 14 items in the batch, 14 ballots, if you will, in this batch. And we can open that batch and take a look at the detail. And each item in this batch is basically one ballot for one voter. And each ballot has a unique ballot ID that's associated with this election and this one voter together uniquely. And so as we process incoming ballots, generally speaking, a lot of counties will have a barcode reader electronically that they will zap the barcode on the envelope that comes in, and when they're in the screen, it will automatically enter that ID number, that unique ID number for that ballot for that voter on this screen, and then we add them to the batch. And once we have a batch of ballots that we have processed, then we can actually go through and verify each one of those, the signatures on each ballot. So we hit the verify button and we bring up a screen that starts with the first item in the batch and we work our way through. Let me see if we have any signatures that will show up among these. Let's open that up first of all. I don't know that we have any signatures. Our demo data here is a little bit thin on this particular spot, but what is supposed to show up here in this particular area is under ballot details, the name of the voter, their address, a place to identify whether we're going to accept or reject the ballot, but on the right-hand side here, their actual signature on file is also supposed to display. And basically, it's the same image that we see from the voter registration record. It just shows up here. It's going to be a little bit small, but they can show the signature for each one of these voters who have a ballot in this batch and verify whether the signature on file matches the signature on the envelope and so on. So we will move through a voter at a time and determine whether we're going to accept or reject that ballot. If we're not sure, we have a way of putting each that particular ballot on hold to give us a chance to do further research and figure out what's going on here. Is this a person trying to vote more than one time? Is this the person we think it is? And so forth. So we have ways of being able to verify and look at voter details. So, for example, this voter, Dylan Redaway, we can look at voter details and look at if there are multiple signatures. I don't have a record in this batch that has the signatures like they're showing in voter registration. But we can look at voter details and see, is this the person we think it is, and are they voting properly? Is this the right ballot? And should we be accepting this ballot or rejecting this ballot? So if we're not sure, we click a button, put this ballot in the hold batch, and that's a whole separate area where we want to go later and research and see what needs to be done with each one of them.
Can
and so
you
forth.
Show them the household ballot? I think Representative Greenlee sure. talked about having the same, if you had more than one ballot for a household.
There's and, Dale Smith.
Yeah, there's a place to...
Yeah, this will show all the ballots that have been issued for this current election to any voter that has the same address. And they would all be listed here, family members, whatever. They're all listed together on the screen. So that may help in the investigation process of determining whose ballot is this and whose signature should we be seeing and so forth.
Do most of the counties have the signatures currently scanned? I know some do, but
we're actually working to try to get them all get their batch scanning done. Some have the full card scanned without the signature clip, so they need to go in and do that. Some just have the signature scanned, and some have none. So we're in the process right now of getting scanners out to the counties and having them do their batch scanning.
Thanks.
See if Dale Smiths. I'm not sure if any of these are the right one. That's multiple signatures.
Go back to that.
Sure.
Those two Dale Smiths. I was curious about that.
Yeah, these are all the same person. What this shows is multiple ballots have been issued to the same voter. And that's possible in cases where the original ballot, for whatever reason, either didn't make it to the voter in the mail, or when it got there, it was lost or damaged or whatever. So perhaps the voter has requested a replacement ballot, or maybe the state or county has discovered that they left something off the original ballot and have to print a supplemental, so they send out another ballot or maybe even a replacement ballot to take the place of the first one. So there could be cases where there are multiple ballots current for the same voter.
Happened to me.
And the system knows which is the most current and which is the one that should be processed when they come back in.
Yeah. And in this case, two of them have come back.
That's right.
The first and third line. So then.
That's right.
But only one will be processed. That's not for sure.
Yeah, only one ballot of all these that make it out to the voter can be processed. And the system knows which one is the most recent, most correct one.
And it says right, you can see it says the message down here, reject this duplicate ballot. So the system will prompt them.
Has there been any discussion about any other kind of identifying feature besides signatures, as in fingerprints or pictures or anything else? It's always just
driver's license number and last four social security
and signature. Yeah, not at this point.
DNA.
Retinal scan.
Liquid scan.
In addition to what we've seen so far, we also have an elections management module, which basically allows each county to set up the election and follow it through all the way to completion, step by step. So it's kind of a checklist feature that allows them to set up elections, set up the races, the measures, the districts that are going to be included in this election, set up all that information and get it ready so that then when we generate ballots and they come back in, it all fits together and makes sense. We have an election workers module that just lets us keep track of the election workers who are helping with a given election. We have a petitions module that allows counties to process various petitions that are circulated and certified and so forth and verify signatures on those petitions. And most of the rest of these items are background administration, system configuration, user admin with various lookup values that make the system work properly for each county and for the state as well. And then we have a whole section on reports and labels that I think we have over 100 reports available in the system now that counties have available and the state have available to grant all kinds of information in different ways. And I think we're even adding to that number. So over time, we're going to have lots and lots of different reports. In addition to which, in the voter registration module itself, there is a query function that lets you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I wanted to practice.
If I had the gavel, I'd tell you out of order.
Is this also going to result in centralized reporting of the election results so that you'll have a central repository on election night instead of having 36 counties to report?
Representative Marsh, the tally systems are not connected in any way to the voter registration system. We would not want that for security reasons, especially since our voter registration system is an internet-based system. We wouldn't want to create a way into your tally system through the internet. So there is no technical connection between the two. In the last election, we did, for the first time in Oregon, have an election night reporting system in an official state site where we took the results from the counties and compiled them all. And we will continue to work on that system. There are no plans right now to make it part of a voter registration system, however.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're doing good, I think.
Any other questions?
Well, given that our questions are restricted to only what's within the presentation, I guess I don't have any other questions.
Well, I think right now, if you have another question, go right ahead and ask it.
This is great. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. my question really is back to kind of a follow-up to my other question. You know, I know that this new system is probably going to eliminate students who receive, which kind of goes with what Chair Kitt said, who might receive a ballot at their home address and then also receive a ballot at their college address. And quite by accident, it happened to my son, Evan, who's a student at Lewis and Clark. He decided that he wanted to vote in the mayor's race in Portland more than he wanted to vote for his mother in Eugene. So he... and so he re-registered in Portland a little late, and so he still got his ballot in Eugene. And then because it did cause a family flare-up, he chose to vote in Eugene instead of Portland. because at that point, he already knew that the mayor's race was decided in Portland anyway.
It had become a matter of inheritance.
Yeah. But several of his friends, you know, said, well, this is great because now you can vote twice for for the president of your choice. And he said, well, it's a felony conviction. And they said, but, you know, there's no way to check it, so you can't be caught. Well, needless to say, he didn't vote twice. But I just was curious to know if that is correct. There was no way to cross-reference if you vote twice.
Well, there. I mean, so much of election law, the way it is currently, so much of election law is dependent on if somebody did try to do that, somebody else telling on them. I can go through lots of our election laws that are dependent on that kind of situation for enforcement. What this tool will do will be able to to make it easier for us to track that person. Mm-hmm. And the features just explained to you will show how if they've been issued a ballot already in an old county and they try to register in the new county receiving that record will be able to see that they've already been issued a ballot in the old county, and it should make it easier for us to deal with situations like that and not let them happen.
With this new centralized voter registration system... Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair. All right, thank you. With the new centralized voter registration system, if he were to vote in both, would there be a way to check to see that Evan Farr had already voted in Multnomah County or had already voted in Lane County? So
yeah.
Okay, he wouldn't be allowed to vote twice, so actually it's proactive in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there ought to be a piece of this law that allows moms to decide where those guys are.
I agree.
Well, thank you very much for
thank
your
you.
Demonstration. Yeah. I really do appreciate it. I helped request that you do it here, and I really do appreciate that. We're very much concerned with these issues, and we're hearing about them now all over the state. So.
Yeah. If you have further questions, I can take my card, and you can contact me here. We have our website.
What is your website?
Good question.
Excuse me. The staff would like to ask.
Do you have a narrative summary of the project at all?
We do, actually.
Yeah, we have tons.
I don't want
we have so much stuff.
I want a narrative summary.
We'll find
executive
for you.
Narrative summary.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
We're here today, and I'll send out the link to
you. Okay, I'll give you my card.
Yes. Thank you. That's very good, actually.
Seth, is there any other business before us today?
No, Mr. Chair.
It's adjourned.
Okay.